Okay, so in terms of, some of you have lots of questions about interpretations of that electron double slit experiment and all that sort of thing. Rob has really built up his resume wrestling with those ideas of how to interpret and understand quantum mechanics. He's received several awards for that, and he is one of the clearest speakers on this topic people come across. Feel free to ask questions. He's not a scary guy. Okay? But also, let's get through the material as quickly as you can. He's going to join us for lunch. So if you have something that's kind of really particular and not right away, you know, he's going to take us off track. Let's save it for lunch, maybe. And we'll have the conversation. All right? So let's welcome Rob.
So as Dave said, I work on the foundations of quantum theory. And one of the deepest issues, the deepest problems in the foundations of quantum theory is a result called Bell's theorem. So basically, I've devoted this whole lecture to trying to explain Bell's theorem to you in a way that's as understandable as possible so that you can really see the mystery. And so there's going to be very little about the rest of quantum mechanics in this particular talk. Now, one of the reasons Bell's theorem is so important is that, as you'll see, what it reveals is that there's a kind of tension between quantum theory on the one hand and relativity theory on the other. And this is Einstein's theory of general relativity. And because these are the two central pillars of modern physics, the fact that there's a tension between them is a real issue. And as you probably know, we haven't yet succeeded at unifying these. So Bell's theorem might be a clue for how to do that. Now, sometimes it takes a while before you find the right framework for formulating a particular problem. And so recently, I and some other people in the field of quantum foundations have realized that there's some interesting work out there that provides a really nice framework for talking about Bell's theorem. So this is work that wasn't done by physicists. It was primarily done by people in the field of machine learning, which is the new name for the field of artificial intelligence, and also by people in statistics and by some philosophers. And that work was really about trying to figure out the following problem, which is we often have studies that give us correlations, that give us just statistical data, like a drug trial is a good example. You see that certain things are correlated, but you want to know, does this cause that? Or if you have many variables, you know, what causes what? What generates this correlation? So these things are called causal discovery algorithms. They have correlations between a bunch of variables as their input, and they're trying to figure out what the causal structure is. So it turns out that this framework of causal discovery algorithms is a really great way of trying to understand what's going on with Bell's theorem. So in the first half of the talk, I'm going to tell you about how that framework works, and then we're going to apply it to Bell's theorem. All right. So first of all, let me just be totally clear on what the difference between correlation and causation is, because we're going to be talking a lot about these two things, correlation and causation. So here's a strong correlation, the rooster crowing and the sun rising. Now, what's distinctive about a correlation is that it's a kind of symmetric relationship. So correlation is really about your knowledge. So what it says is that if you learn something about one variable, you can infer something about another variable. Okay, so in this case, if you're in the farmhouse and the drapes are down and you hear the rooster crow, you can infer that the sun must be rising. Or if you read in your almanac that in a month from now the sun will rise at 6 a.m., then you can infer that the rooster will crow at 6 a.m. So you can make the inference in either direction. The correlation supports that. Causation is different. Causation is about coming in and controlling one variable and thereby controlling another variable. So for example, here, if I make the rooster crow in the middle of the night by, I don't know, squeezing it or whatever, it doesn't make the sun rise, right? You know, the sun won't rise as a result of my making the rooster crow at an unusual time. But if I make the sun rise early, say by taking the rooster and moving it towards the east on the earth so that for the rooster the sun rises early, then you find that actually the rooster will crow early. So it's the sun rising that causes the rooster to crow, not vice versa. Okay, so you see that they're very different sorts of things. Causation is about control and influence. Correlation is about inference, what you can deduce about something based on your knowledge of something else. Okay, so you've probably heard this slogan that correlation does not imply causation, right? Because, you know, if I have two things, there could be a common cause that explains the correlation. It's actually, it's a really tricky problem. So I'm going to describe a paradox from statistics for you, and you're going to see just how subtle this whole issue is of trying to infer causal relations from correlations. So imagine we have a drug trial, okay? So you've got some population of sick people, and for some subpopulation, you administer a drug. And then you just keep track of what fraction of that subpopulation recovers from their illness and what fraction does not. Okay, so you write down the probability of recovery given that somebody got administered the drug. And what you find is that it's higher than the probability of recovery for those who didn't get the drug. Okay, so what are you likely to conclude in that case? Is the drug good or not?
Yes.
Seems like it's a good drug. So probably if you have this illness, you'd want to take this drug. Now, here's the surprising thing. You decide, okay, I'm going to go look at that data a little bit further, and I'm going to just look at the men. And I'm going to take the subpopulation of men who got the drug and look at their rate of recovery and the subpopulation of men who didn't get the drug. And now it goes the other way. For the men, you're more likely to recover if you didn't get the drug than if you got the drug. So you think, well, if I'm a man, maybe I shouldn't take the drug. Now, here's the really surprising bit. When you look at the subpopulation of women, it also goes the other way. And that's really weird, because the naive interpretation of these things, well, you know, how do you make sense of this? If you're a man, you shouldn't take the drug. If you're a woman, you shouldn't take the drug. But if you're a member of the general population, you should. Doesn't make any sense. Yes?
That's because you don't have to sum the probabilities. You have to sum the statistical data that provide these probabilities. For example, this can be tricky because the amount of men can be higher than the amount of female, for example.
Yes.
So once you sum all the data, then you got the total probability.
So I think you're saying that we shouldn't think of these three equations as necessarily contradictory. And that's true, and we'll see that in a minute. But let me ask you just, is it clear to you just based on this whether you should take the drug or not? That's the question we really want to answer, right? We want to know what is the causal influence of taking this drug on the rate of recovery. So, you know, even if we can become comfortable with this, we still want to know, you know, is the drug effective or not? So here's some actual data. I don't mean real world data. I just mean an example of data that can give these sorts of probabilities. So let's go through it. So in this particular trial, 300 men got the drug. 180 recovered, and so you can calculate that. That's a 60% recovery rate. If you look at the men who didn't get the drug, there was 100 of them, and 70 recovered. That's a 70% recovery rate. So indeed, for men, it's they have a higher rate of recovery for those who didn't take the drug. And then over here, for the women, you see 100 got the drug, 20 recovered. That's only a 20% recovery rate. 300 didn't, 90 recovered. That's a 30% recovery rate. So again, better not to take the drug. But now if you say, well, what about the combined statistics? Well, overall, if I look at the denominators here, there's 400 people who got the drug. And if I sum these up, 200 recover. That's a 50% recovery rate. Whereas over here, 400 got the drug, 160 recover. That's only a 40% recovery rate. So sure enough, for the full population, it's better to take the drug than not take the drug. All right, maybe I shouldn't say better. It's just a higher rate of recovery for those who took the drug. So this should convince you that, you know, I wasn't lying. This can really happen. And now we need to know, well, how do we make sense of this? What does it mean? Is the drug effective or not? Okay, so it turns out that when I first came across this many years ago, I never really understood it until this work by people in machine learning on causal inference. I think that's really the right resolution. And so it has to do with causal structure. So this is the idea. I'm first going to say, well, why does this seem like such a paradox? And the reason it seems like a paradox is that when you ask, well, what do I think is going on? Probably what you have in mind is something like this. So these arrows are meant to represent causal influences. So when you ask, well, what could possibly influence the recovery rate? The answer is, well, certainly the treatment, whether you got the drug or not, that could have a causal influence. But maybe also gender. It could be, for instance, that, you know, men recover more easily from this disease than women do. That happens with a lot of illnesses. And if that's what you think is going on, then strictly speaking, this can't arise, okay, this set of inequalities. Because if I just took the probability of being male and the probability of being female, so I multiply the second equation by the probability of being male, and I sum that with the third equation multiplied by the probability of female, being female, then on the left-hand side, I would get the overall probability of recovery given that somebody got the drug. That would just be the expression for the overall probability. And on the right, I would get the overall probability for recovery given that you didn't take the drug. And that would give the wrong inequality compared to the first equation. So this is sort of, I think, you know, what we have in mind, that it's sort of, there's no correlation between gender and treatment. And that's, if this were the causal structure, then sure enough, there would be no correlation between gender and treatment. But the solution is that this is not the causal structure. This is the causal structure. That actually, the gender causally influences whether somebody gets the treatment or not. So if you look back at this data, you'll notice that 300 men got the drug, 100 didn't, whereas 100 women got the drug and 300 didn't. So that means that this was not a fair drug trial. It wasn't the case that men and women got the drug at equal rates. There was this bias. So for example, it might be that the patients in this trial got to choose whether they got the drug or not, and perhaps the men were more predisposed to take the treatment than the women were. Okay, and so that would be reflected in this sort of causal structure, that the men have a preference for the treatment. Okay, so that can resolve this paradox in the following way. So in this particular instance, what can have happened is that, one, the men are more likely to recover from this illness than the women are, regardless of whether they take the drug or not. And two, the men are more likely to receive treatment or to choose the treatment than the women are. So if that's what's happening, okay, and then you're asked, what's the probability of recovery given treatment? So now you're just being asked about a correlation. So you're asked, if I tell you I've got a member of the population here and they received the drug, what do you think? Is it more likely that they recovered or that they didn't recover? Well, then you can reason as follows. If they got the drug, then they were probably a man, or they're more likely to be a man. If they were a man, they were more likely to recover. So if they got the drug, they were more likely to recover. So what you're doing is you're making an inference via this causal channel down here from learning that they got the treatment to learning that they recovered. And it doesn't mean that treatment causally influences recovery. It doesn't mean that treatment is good for recovery. In fact, in this particular example, the drug is bad for recovery, but that effect, the correlation between treatment and recovery in the upper line, is swamped by the stronger effect of the poorly done drug trial, which had gender as a common cause. So questions about that?
So it's sort of like a hidden relation that at first it seems like it causes, but you have to analyze more factors, I guess, to get...
That's right, yeah. So in general, if you do your drug trials poorly, there's any number of variables that could be a common cause. So there's lots of great examples of this. So there's a famous example of somebody who showed that owning a computer is positively correlated with your income. And the suggestion, I think, that as the media reported, was go out and buy a computer, it'll be good for your income. But of course, the real explanation is that those jobs that have you working with computers tend to make more money than those jobs that don't. And then, you know, people came out with a follow-up study that showed that it didn't matter whether your computer was ever turned on or not. It was still positively correlated with your income. So, you know, go out, buy a computer, don't even turn it on, it'll be, you know. Or you know, if you go out and buy a hammer, that'll be bad for your income. So don't buy hammers, whatever you do. It's, yeah, so there's a lot of, actually most, I would say today, even today, most studies that report statistical evidence don't analyze the causal structure properly. They don't really answer the question, what causes what? So if you know, read the newspaper about all the latest drug trials, they'll typically say, well, look, we saw this positive correlation. You know, it suggests that maybe taking vitamin E is, you know, good for this particular illness. But they don't really prove that one causes the other. They just show this association. So the causal discovery algorithms are meant to do better than that and try to extract what the causal relations are from the observed data. Okay, so the key thing here is that in the past, we didn't tend to make a distinction between these two things. There's the probability of recovery given that you observe that somebody took the drug, so that's your inference. And then there's the probability of recovery given that you make somebody take the drug. So this is how you do a drug trial properly. You say, we don't care about your gender, your economic status. We are going to flip a coin to decide whether you get the drug or the placebo. So we take a population and we randomize, right? So now no other factors can be associated with whether they got the drug or not, because it's the outcome of a coin flip, and the coin flip is not associated with anything else. And then you look for a correlation between recovery and treatment, and if you see one, you know it must be because the treatment is effective for recovery, okay? So that's the idea of a randomized trial. And so in this particular example I showed you, it would have been better, of course, to do the drug trial properly, just randomize it. Now the problem is that that's not a solution for the general problem, because there's lots of cases where you just can't do the randomized trial. So, you know, one example is it might be unethical. So say you want to know, does smoking cause lung cancer? And suppose you think it does. Well, you can't go out and take a bunch of would-be non-smokers, make them smoke, verify that, oh yeah, they got lung cancer, you know, now we know. It's just wrong. So you'd much rather say, well, let's just take the natural experiment that's been done with all of its complications and see if we can analyze it in a more intelligent way to deduce whether smoking really causes lung cancer. So another example would be in observational astronomy. You know, you'd very much like to be able to go and change the mass of that star and see what happens, but you can't do any of that. You just have these statistical correlations that you see in the sky, and you're trying to infer what caused what. So these sorts of algorithms are key there as well. And then finally, in quantum mechanics, as you've probably heard, there's limitations on the sorts of things you can control. So for example, if I have a particle, I can't simultaneously control its position and its momentum. Okay, and so I have a limitation on the extent to which I could explore causal mechanisms in quantum mechanics because of the limitations of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So for all those reasons, you'd like to have tools for just going from the observed data to the causal structure. Yes?
Could the fact that the people know that they're taking the drug change it too?
Certainly, like if there's a like a placebo effect. Yeah, if for example they have a more positive attitude because they're on the drug, that might influence their recovery. So if you're doing the randomized trial, you would say let's not let them know whether they're actually getting the drug or the placebo. But in general, you know, we could throw in that sort of factor in a sort of a hypothesis about the causal structure. I could have another variable here, which is about, you know, whether they know that they're taking the drug or not, and how does that influence things? Yes. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the basics of this field. So there's a couple of textbooks that have already been written on these sorts of problems. And so for that, I'm going to need a bit of formalism. So that as physicists, you know, we love formalism. We like to take a problem and make it mathematically rigorous. So what does it mean to really say, you know, what causes what? Well, in this approach, it means to come up with a causal model. So a causal model has two parts to it. There's a part called the causal structure. Okay, so this is just like that picture I was showing you before that had treatment and recovery and gender on it. So these letters now just represent variables. So they could be a binary variable, like the recovery variable or the treatment variable, the gender variable, or they could be variables that have more values. That's fine. And every arrow in this graph represents the existence of a direct causal influence from one variable to another. So here, for example, T directly influences X. T also has an indirect influence on X via Y. Those sorts of things are represented differently here. Okay, and this is called a directed acyclic graph. Acyclic means there are no loops. So you'll never find a set of arrows that loop around and come back to the original point. And that's good because if you did, that would be like a time machine or it'll generate paradoxes, like the grandfather paradox where you go back in time and kill your own grandfather. We don't want that here. So we rule out the loops. Okay, and then on the right, the other part you need for this causal model is a set of probabilities and conditional probabilities. So for each of these variables that have no parents in this graph, right, so they're sort of root nodes, I have to specify the probability distribution over the values of that variable. So like in my previous example, gender was a variable that had no parents. So I would need to talk about in this particular trial, what's the probability of male, what's the probability of female? So you do that for all the root nodes. And then for a node like this one, Y, which has two causal parents, T and W, you specify the probability for Y to take any of its values given all the possible values of its parents, right? So you know, if this were the recovery variable and this were the treatment and the gender variables, then you would say for, you know, men who got the drug, men who didn't got the drug, women who got the drug, women who didn't get the drug, for all four of those cases, what's the probability of recovery? And you would have completely specified this conditional probability. And then, you know, finally for x, for example, it has all these other variables as parents, so I have to specify the probability of different values of x given all of its parents. Yes?
If you know, for example, what the variable t is, mm-hmm. can you eliminate t's influence and then just look at the y, w relation, or can you not do that?
Well, if for example, t is supposed to be distributed probabilistically over its values, if in fact it's focused on just one of its values, like, you know, t is always zero, like, you know, your drug trial is only men, for instance, then it can't support correlations. Like, so I could not get a correlation between treatment and recovery that was influenced by a common cause of gender if everybody's a man, right? So there's no way of supporting that sort of common influence. So you need to have this distribution be not point-like, not fixed on a particular value, in order for these sorts of things to be able to support correlations between the other variables. So you're right, if you know the value of something, then you should just eliminate it from the graph. And you can say, well, there's lots of background variables that we're not including here, you know, facts about the world that we know that aren't influencing anything here because they're fixed. Okay, so if you have this as your causal model, then you've already encoded a very deep principle of science, okay? And it's called Reichenbach's principle. And it's just the idea that statistical correlations should be explained causally, that whenever we see these kinds of statistical correlations in the world, we should seek to explain them causally. So what that means is that if I see, for example, x and y, two variables, are correlated, statistically dependent, then either x causes y, or y causes x, or there's some common cause of x and y, or in fact, there's another couple of possibilities. Maybe I have a common cause and a direct cause acting simultaneously. But it has to be one of these options. That's the idea, that we're going to try to explain correlations causally. And that's a very generic idea that you'll find across science, that when we see correlations in our data, there has to be some causal explanation. And the beauty of having this causal explanation is then you then have some control. You know, if you know that this is the causal explanation over here on the left, then you know that, okay, if I go in and I control the value of x, I can come to control the value of y, but not vice versa. Controlling y won't allow me to control x. And that's the kind of stuff we want in science. We want to be able to have control over systems. So the way Reichenbach's principle is encoded in this model I just told you about is that I said that these variables that have no parents, s, t, w, were independently distributed, which means I didn't allow for correlations between them. I could have written down a probability distribution over W, S, and T that allowed, you know, them to be correlated in some way. For example, you know, maybe they all take the same value, whatever it is. But I didn't allow that. And the reason I don't allow that is because if I did, it would say that there's a correlation that was not explained by this causal graph, because these guys have no way to become correlated in this graph. There's no direct link between S and W. There's no common cause of S and W. So if I think S and W should be correlated, I should encode it in my hypothesis, right? I should put in a common cause of S and W to make them correlated. If I don't think that common cause is there, then I'm basically, if I'm committed to Reichenbach's principle, I have to make them independently distributed. Okay, so when you do that, you work this all out. You can prove that the joint distribution you would observe over these five variables is just the product of these guys. So what I'm saying is that if nature is governed by this causal model, there are five variables, they're connected in these ways with these distributions, and then I just go out and I measure each of these five variables and I look at the overall probability distribution that those statistics give me, it's just this product. Okay? And now, what's a causal discovery algorithm or a causal inference algorithm? It's something that solves the inverse problem. So I just told you how to go from a hypothesis about the causal structure to what you would observe in your statistical experiment. But what we really want to do is go the other way. We want to have an algorithm that has as its input what you've observed in your statistical experiment, this joint distribution over five variables in this case, and figure out what are the causal models that could have given rise to it. You know, is in those models, does x cause y or does y cause x? Things like that. That's what we really want to understand. And typically in science, you know, solving the inverse problem is harder. So that's what we want to do here. Okay. So I'm going to tell you about two kinds of tricks that go into these algorithms. And they're both going to be relevant for what we say about Bell's theorem. And the first sort of trick looks at statistical dependencies among variables. Okay, statistical independencies, really. So here's the idea. I'm first going to define a notion of just independence, and then I'll come back to conditional independence. So A and B are independent, or statistically independent, if any of the following equivalent conditions hold. So one would be that if I look at, all right, I'll write them out and then I'll explain them. So we'll start with the third. The joint probability of A and B factorizes into the probability of A times the probability of B. So this is perhaps the easiest way to think about independence. It says, just look, there are no correlations between A and B. So we say they are statistically independent. They're just uncorrelated, right? So it might be that, you know, A and B are each coin flips. So there's a probability of half for heads and tails here. There's a probability of half for heads and tails here. And then the joint distribution is just a quarter for each of the four strings, heads, 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 tails, and so on. And so I can write it as a product. Whereas if I had two coins that were correlated, like probability half that they're both heads and probability half that they're both tails, then I could not write this joint distribution as a product. Okay? Now, it turns out that you can define something called the conditional probability, which is just the probability of A and B divided by the probability of B. That's the conditional probability of A given B. So it says, if, you know, for every possible value of B, what's the distribution over the values of A? So you can just define in terms of that. If you calculate this using this equation, you immediately get this, that the probability of A given B is equal to the probability of A. So intuitively, what that means is that when you describe what you know about A, the probability distribution, if you condition on what you know about B, it's irrelevant. It doesn't change what you know about A. So that's another way of thinking that they're independent, right? Learning about B teaches me nothing about A. They're statistically independent. And then by symmetry, you can get a similar relation here. Learning about A teaches me nothing about B. Okay? So these are all equivalent ways of talking about two variables being independent or uncorrelated. Now, this notion up here is a bit more subtle. It's called conditional independence. And it looks exactly like that, except now I say A and B are independent given C if the probability of A given C times the probability of B given C gives me this joint probability. So they can be correlated now. A and B can be correlated. But if you already know the value of C, if you condition on a particular value of C, they become uncorrelated. And so another way of describing that is, you know, here, if it may be that learning B teaches me something about A, but in the context of already knowing C, learning B teaches you nothing about A. So C is enough to tell you everything about A. Adding B into your conditioning doesn't change anything. Okay, so this is a concept that people use a lot in statistics about what kinds of dependences there are between variables, given other variables. I'm going to denote it this way. So this little perpendicular symbol means uncorrelated, independent. Okay? And so A is independent of B given C in this notation. Good. So let's look at how causal structure can influence the independence relations we observe. So take this example up top. It's a causal fork. B is a common cause of A and C. So in that sort of scenario, you would expect that A and C could be correlated. So for example, the gender was a common cause for the recovery and the treatment variables, and they could make them correlated. So I would see that A is not independent of C generically. That's what this crossed out bar means, correlated. However, if I condition on B, they become uncorrelated. So the idea is this. When I say two things are correlated, remember back to the rooster example, it means that learning one can teach me about the other. So in this case, sure, learning A can teach me something about C. But if I already know everything about B, then it won't teach me anything. Because why does learning A teach me something about C? It teaches me something about C because learning A teaches me something about B, and knowing that teaches me something about C. But if I tell you, look, you already know everything about B, well, then you're going to say, well, learning A is not going to teach me anything new about C. And therefore, A is independent of C in the context of already knowing B. Okay? Let's look at another example. So here we have the common cause, as we did before, and also a direct cause. So here you'll have that A and C are correlated. And furthermore, they're still correlated even if I condition on B. And the reason is that there's two ways to correlate A and C now. I can do it via this common cause or via the direct cause. So learning, if I already know B, learning A can still teach me something about C because A can directly influence C. And learning, knowing B won't destroy that, right? The fact that A can still teach me something about C. All right, one more example. It's called the collider. So A and C both influence B. So B is a common effect of A and C. So Reichenbach's principle tells us A and C should be independent because they're parentless in this diagram. And now here's an interesting thing, that they can become dependent, they can become correlated when you condition on B. That's sometimes called Bergson's paradox, but it's really not so paradoxical. A good example would be if there's a school that admits students based either on academic talents or musical ability, then you tend to find that those two features are correlated, anti-correlated at school. So if you condition on knowing that somebody got admitted to the school, then if you find that they have good musical ability, then you learn something that they don't necessarily have to be so academically talented, and if you find that they're academically talented, they don't have to necessarily be so musically talented. Or if I have an AND gate in a circuit and I condition on the output of that AND gate, that will correlate the inputs. It'll mean that when I learn one of the inputs, I can infer something about the other input. Okay, so you already start to see how these different patterns of independences that we can see among these variables teach us something about what the causal structure was. There are distinctive patterns of independences. And that's sort of natural, that when you say, certain things are statistically independent, it should teach you something about what causes what. So these algorithms try to encode these sorts of inferences. So, okay, here's your first opportunity to do causal inference. This is your first challenge. Suppose I told you there are three variables, A, B, and C. They're the only ones that are causally relevant. Okay, so there's some causal structure that involves just the three of them. And you find the joint distribution over A, B, and C. Okay? And you look for independences. And what you find is that A and B are independent, which means if you take the marginal distribution over A and B alone, so you forget about C, it factorizes. The probability of A and B factorizes, and they are uncorrelated. A and B are uncorrelated. But every other independence is absent, right? So if you look at A and C, they're correlated. If you look at B and C, they're correlated. If you look at whether A is independent of B given C, you find no. If I condition on C, A and B are dependent. They're correlated if I condition on C. So although they're marginally independent, if I condition on C, they become dependent. Similarly for every other triple. So the question is, given all of those facts about the independences, this is the only one, what's the causal structure? So give yourselves a couple of minutes. You can talk amongst yourselves, and then I'll ask to see if you can tell me what the causal structure is.
Between A and F, and then 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 between A and F, and leading up from C to A.
So does anybody have any suggestions? Any candidates for answers? Yes.
We think it might be a fork, so going from C to B and A.
Like this?
Yes.
Okay, let's test that out. So if you had a common cause for A and B, would you expect A and B to be correlated generically? What do people think?
Yes.
So if gender can influence both treatment and recovery, right? So men can be more likely to get the drug, men can be more likely to recover. Then I see that getting the drug and recovering will become correlated. And so I wouldn't see this independence if this were the causal structure. So other ideas for what it might be? Yes?
Collider, so A causes C and B causes C.
Like this. Yeah, so that works because we know that parentless variables should be uncorrelated by Reichenbach's principle. So A is going to be independent of B. Because B causes C, I expect them to be correlated. Because A causes C, I expect A and C to be correlated. And then I also expect that A is going to be correlated with B given C. That's the tricky one, right? So I expect A is not independent of B given C. They're correlated. And because that's what we saw in the collider example with, you know, the case of the AND gate, for example, learning C starts to correlate A and B for this guy. So that's right. This can do justice to the independences we've seen. Great. Now, here's the, so that's basically how these sorts of algorithms work. But here's the tricky point, and it's going to let me tell you about one of the other principles that go into these algorithms. The tricky point is that here's a causal structure that, logically speaking, could do justice to these independences. So it's when where C is a common cause of A and B, as was suggested earlier, but also B can cause A. And so the idea here is that if I choose the parameters in this model extremely carefully, I can make this consistent with that independence. So generically, this won't have that independence. But for example, if A and B are positively correlated by virtue of the direct cause, and they're made to be negatively correlated by virtue of the common cause, in just such a way that those two factors cancel out and make them uncorrelated, I can get what we've seen. Okay? Now, what that means in terms of the math is that if I choose the conditional probability of A given B, C, and B given C, and the probability of C in exactly the right way, I can ensure, I can fix, and make sure I get this independence. But any small variation in those guys will fail to reproduce that. So this is a very funny explanation because it only works for, you know, a very unique set of values for these parameters. And generically, for this kind of causal structure, it wouldn't generate that. So one of the principles of these algorithms is that we should reject these sorts of explanations. They're bad explanations. They require fine-tuning, right? So I need to choose these parameters extremely carefully to explain what's been observed. And the idea is that it's unlikely that nature, you know, would have chosen those parameters just so carefully to make me think that the top one was the causal structure when in fact it was this one. Okay, so an example that people sometimes give is, you know, when you see a chair and you're asked how many chairs are there, you say one chair. And somebody says, well, logically it's possible that there's a second chair that's positioned just right such that it's obfuscated by the first chair, right? So it's, you know, in the distance just behind the first chair. So that's logically possible. There could be two chairs. It's just unlikely because for almost every position of the second chair, you would see that there are two chairs. And it's only this one position that makes it seem like there's one chair. So similarly here, it would be only for this very particular values of these guys that I could explain what I've seen. Okay, so we use this sort of principle a lot in science, that we don't want explanations that are very non-robust to change. Like if I just vary things a little bit here, it becomes a bad explanation. Whereas up top, no matter what I choose for these parameters here, I always see this pattern of independences, right? It's this pattern of independence is enforced by the causal structure alone. Good. Okay, so that's, that tells you about the first trick. This is the principle of no fine tuning, which I add to Reichenbach's principle as one of the sort of basic principles of these sorts of algorithms. So some causal model of your observed distribution is fine tuned if the conditional independences only hold for a set of measure zero of the values of the parameters in the model. So what that means is for just a very small number relative to all the possible numbers of all the possible ways in which those parameters could take their values. And so no fine tuning says we don't infer causal models. Causal models that have this feature are not good explanations of what we've seen. Okay, so let's go to our favorite example of the smoking and lung cancer, which I talked about in the beginning. So say you've gone to the lab or you've done an experiment and you've seen that smoking and developing lung cancer are correlated in a large population. So you might think, well, perhaps smoking causes cancer. That's one hypothesis about what's going on. But there are other hypotheses, and the tobacco companies were quick to point out that it is entirely possible that there's a genetic factor that predisposes people to crave nicotine while simultaneously predisposing them to develop cancer at higher rates. And the tobacco companies were right. That is a logically possible explanation for the correlations we've seen. So we'd like to have some tools to say, you know, which is it? Is it smoking that causes lung cancer or something else? And so it turns out that if we go and we do a little bit more work and we look at a third variable, which I'll call T, which is whether somebody has tar in their lungs or not, okay? So you look at the joint distribution over the smoking variable, the cancer variable, and the whether you have tar in your lungs or not variable. And suppose that you find that although smoking is correlated with cancer, when I condition on people having tar in the lungs, they become independent. Okay? Suppose that's what you've seen in this distribution. And you see no other independences. Well, then you can immediately rule out the tobacco company hypothesis, because no matter what the causal relation between tar and these smoking and cancer variables are, it doesn't matter what sorts of arrows I put in up top. If there were a common cause for smoking and cancer, then I would expect that learning whether somebody has tar in the lungs would not eliminate all the correlations between smoking and cancer. There would remain some correlations that were due to this common cause of the genetic factor. And yet the data has told me that learning whether somebody has tar in the lungs does make them uncorrelated. And therefore, if this is the causal structure, the only way I could explain this is by this kind of unnatural sort of fine-tuning. And we're going to reject that. So so that's nice. It says that, you know, this sort of idea, which seems plausible, is, you know, there's a way of, if you collect data and you see this, you can rule that out. Whereas the hypothesis that smoking causes tar in the lungs, which causes cancer, is completely consistent with this. Because if I already know that somebody has tar in their lungs, learning that they're a smoker doesn't help me predict whether they have cancer any better. So smoking teaches me nothing about the cancer variable, given that I already know the tar variable. That makes sense of this independence relation. Yes?
So in the second one, you couldn't say that smoking causes cancer, right? Because it doesn't reveal anything.
That's right. It's an indirect causal influence via tar in the lungs. That's right. Yeah, so in this case, you would want to say still that smoking is an indirect cause of cancer, which has some causal mediaries along the way. But ultimately, it's a cause.
What does the first diagram mean?
So in the first diagram, all these dashed lines just mean whatever you want to put in here. So for example, the tobacco company could have said that, I don't know, tar in the lungs maybe is caused by having cancer, or you know, any number of other possible relationships that could arise. And what I'm saying is just it doesn't matter. The whole idea that there could be a common cause for smoking and cancer through a genetic factor is ruled out by what you've observed. Okay. All right. So that's just, you know, a toy example of an application of these kinds of algorithms, and I haven't told you about all the details of these things, but this is sort of how they work. Now I told you there were two tricks. So we're closing in on Bell's theorem now. I'm going to tell you about very quickly about the second trick that's used. And this trick, although it was, you know, discovered by people who were doing these causal discovery algorithms, it was actually first discovered by John Bell, a physicist, when he discovered Bell's theorem back in the 60s. So I'm going to tell you about that shortly. But let me just give it to you in this sort of framework. So it's making inferences about the causal structure not based on what's independent of what, but based on how strong the correlations are. Okay, so what do I mean by that? Well, here's just a really simple example. Suppose you have three binary variables, x, y, and z, And you observe that they are perfectly correlated. So they're with probability half, they all take the value 0. With probability half, they all take the value 1. And here's two hypotheses about the causal structure that you're trying to evaluate. So in this one, each of these variables has a single variable as a common cause for all three. Turns out that can do justice to what we've seen. Because, for example, lambda here could itself be a binary variable. It's just a coin flip. It could have probability half of being 0 or 1. And then these causal influences could just say, you know, x is a copy of lambda, and y is a copy of lambda, and z is a copy of lambda. And so that would give me what we have here, just three correlated variables. So that's no problem. But this guy up top cannot explain these correlations. So what's going on up top is that every pair of these observed variables has a single variable as a common cause for the two. So there's no variable that acts as a common cause for all three in this diagram, just these pairwise ones. So it's a bit tricky to see why this causal structure cannot explain this. So I'm going to see if I can explain it. It's if I look at just x and y, okay, so I ignore z. So what I find is that x and y are perfectly correlated. When x is 0, y is always 0. When x is 1, y is always 1. So if I say, how could I explain that perfect correlation between x and y? Well, that's not hard. I can make this new variable here a coin flip. And I can make x and y copies of that coin flip. And that does it. Okay, makes x and y perfectly correlated. But now, if y didn't just depend on nu, if it wasn't just a copy of nu, but it was some more complicated function that involved nu and mu up here, okay, then that would not allow me to have perfect correlation between x and y. And the reason is that x doesn't know anything about mu. If you follow arrows out of mu, none of them land on x, right? They land on z and y. There's no way for mu to influence x. So what that means is that x just it does not depend on mu at all. It has no knowledge of what mu's value is. Therefore, if y was a function of mu, then x could not reproduce the values of that function. You know, x doesn't know what mu is. So as I vary the value of mu, the value of y would change. But there's no way that x could track that value because it doesn't know what mu is. So therefore, if x and y are going to be perfectly correlated, it has to be that y doesn't depend at all on mu. And then you just run the same argument with x and y flipped, and you find that for x and y to be perfectly correlated, x can't know anything about lambda here. But that means that x and y cannot be correlated with z at all. So what you find is that if you enforce perfect correlation of x and y in this causal structure, you find that they're totally uncorrelated with z. People sometimes call this monogamy. You know, you can only be perfectly correlated with one other variable in this causal structure. And so you can't have this guy because here all three of them are perfectly correlated with one another. This is a polygamous correlation. So what you find is that these arguments have nothing to do with fine-tuning. This causal structure just cannot, as a matter of logic, explain this kind of distribution. So if you go to the world and you see this distribution, you can immediately rule out this possibility as a causal explanation. So in fact, it's a much more powerful tool than the stuff I was showing you earlier. The stuff I was showing you earlier, it was logically possible that these other causal structures could explain what you saw, just really implausible. Whereas here, it's not about implausibility. It's saying there's certain guys that are just ruled out as a matter of logic. OK, so those are the two key tricks. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to say, what about quantum correlations? So you might have heard that in the quantum world, we have some bizarre correlations that we observe. And so the perspective on Bell's theorem I want to give you today is, well, you know, what if we took all these tricks about trying to infer causal explanations of the correlations we've seen, and we apply them in the quantum world? What does it teach us about the kinds of possibilities for explaining what's going on? And so in particular, I'm going to look at the standard Bell-type experiment, which works as follows. It prepares a pair of particles in a very specific way called an entangled state, which I don't know if you've heard of or not, but it's a particular quantum state for a pair of particles. And it sends those particles to two different wings of the experiment, which we'll imagine are very far apart. And then it subjects each particle to a measurement. And so in my notation here, x sets the dial of the measurement. So it determines what kind of measurement you're doing, so position or momentum, or in the case of say an electron, it could be whether you're measuring the spin along Z or X, or whether you're measuring photon polarization in one basis or another. That's all set by this variable. And then A is going to be the outcome of that measurement, which is, again, is going to be either yes, it was, you know, polarized in this direction, or no, it was not. It's always a yes-no outcome in my example. And similarly with the other particle, Y will be the setting, B will be the outcome. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the joint distribution that quantum mechanics predicts for these four variables. What kinds of correlations do I see between these outcomes and settings? And then we're going to want to know what possible causal structures, what possible sets of arrows between these four variables could possibly explain what quantum mechanics predicts for this experiment. OK, so now the way we're going to do this is, we're first going to basically ask about this causal structure. So this is sort of the natural causal structure. If you think about it, we've got these two particles together at one time. They go off, and they get subjected to measurements far apart from one another. So you say, well, maybe the particles are a common cause for the outcomes of those two experiments. And of course, the local setting might influence the outcome as well. So what I'm measuring over here on the left could influence what sort of distribution of outcomes I get. Similarly, over here on the right, what I'm measuring, that's the Y variable, could influence what I get. But this seems like the perfectly natural explanation of what must be going on in this experiment. So we're going to look at that, how well that sort of causal explanation can do in explaining these correlations. OK, so this is the part where I'm going to tell you about the details of Bell's theorem. So we're just going to look at these two outcome measurements. And for the purposes here, I'm going to just talk about the outcome as being an LED light coming on, green or red. And the choice of the measurement, the setting, is just going to be, I'm going to call it H or T. So it could be a polarization degree of freedom of a photon, or it might be spin of an electron. It doesn't really matter. For this whole discussion, what you're using doesn't matter. There's just two different settings, H and T, each of which has two outcomes. And so the experiment we're going to imagine is one where you choose the setting on each side totally at random, just by a coin flip. So actually, this is where H and T came from, heads, tails. So at the end of the day, there's only one of four types of measurements that are going to happen. They're either both heads, heads and tails, tails and heads, or both tails. Those are the four experiments that are happening, each with equal probability. OK, and now I'm going to tell you about the kinds of correlations. So we're going to go through a few different possibilities for what those correlations might look like and how we might explain them causally. And this is the bit where I'm going to need your help. So I'm going to want two volunteers to basically play the role of the two particles in this experiment and try to generate the correlations that we see. And this is where Alex and Mary are going to help me. So do I have two volunteers? Oh, and I should mention, there's cash prizes to be won. So you will each win a loonie if you manage to solve this problem. OK. Here, and how about you as well? Great. So if you come up to the front, I'll explain the rules of the game. So Marie, if you could just situate yourself way over there. Alex, you stay on this side. And the two of you are going to be here in the middle. Great. OK, so you're basically going to be playing the role of the two particles that go off to their detectors. Marie and Alex are going to flip coins to decide whether they're measuring heads or tails. And then your job is going to be to deliver an answer, which is going to be red or green. So you're sort of simulating the particle, giving a red or green outcome to a particular measurement, H or T. Okay. At the beginning, you're going to get to consult. You're going to get to come up with a plan. Like your plan could be something like, look, if I get H, I'm going to give green. And if you get H, you should give red, or you know, whatever. Like, so that sort of plan. Because once you're out on the other two sides, you're not going to learn what the other person is being measured as, right? So you're not allowed to shout across the room, I got heads over here. What'd you get? You know, we're going to be watching you. That's not allowed. You will not win the money if you do that. And they're going to flip the coin and write heads or tails on a little piece of paper so that they're not telling you either, so that you can't hear it across the room. And then I'm just going to want you to write your answer on the piece of paper so that also we don't hear it across the room. Okay? So that's how it's all going to go down. Now I'm going to explain to you what kinds of correlations you need to generate to win the game. Okay? So here it is. So it's, like I said before, you know, there's going to be two possibilities for the measurements, two possibilities for the outcomes. Now here's the deal. If it so happens that the same measurement is made on both sides, okay, so it's either H and H or T and T, the coins come up that way, then you will win if your answers agree. So if you guys have reported green and green or red and red when I collect the cards, you will win. If, however, it happens that the coins come out such that different measurements are being made on the two sides, then you will only win if your answers disagree, if you have red and green or green and red. So is that clear what the correlations you're trying to generate are?
So, wait, they're going to flip the tails, and then we get to decide whether we want red or green to go either way.
You're going to report, like when you get to the station, once you learn whether it's heads or tails, you're going to report green or red as an outcome. One thing you could do is just, you know, choose at random, but I suggest that you think about a kind of a cooperated strategy, because you're going to have to generate these certain kinds of correlations, whereas if you just generated results at random, they would tend to be uncorrelated. So you're going to want to talk for a while about how you're going to respond to the questions you get. You have a few minutes, so I'm going to let, okay, so everybody should talk amongst yourselves, even though you're not up here. Try to figure out how you would solve this problem. Okay, and there's going to be more opportunity for winning money because we're going to come up with a couple of other problems. So just take a few minutes and just let me know, you know, when you're ready. Ready? Okay, we're ready here. So stay in the middle for a second. Coin flippers, ready with your cards? Okay, so, we're gonna do it. So I'm gonna have the two of you flip your coins at the same time and then mark down on the piece of paper your outcome. And you guys are gonna head off, first you guys are gonna head off to the other sides, good. Now we have the coin flips. Write it on the piece of paper. And then we're gonna have the particles answer by taking the pen, yeah, and writing on the paper what their answer is. And I'll just collect the results. Thank you. And there we go. Okay, drum roll. So on the left, we had tails. I just need a spot here to write. All right. On the left, we had tails, and the answer was red. And on the right, we had tails, and the answer was red.
Yay!
And you win. So you can collect your cash prizes, which I assume are still here. Yeah, good. Great. Okay, so you've got the idea. What was your strategy? First, let me ask.
H was green, T was red.
Good. Okay, yeah, simple strategy. So here's a way of illustrating that you know what you're trying to do in the case where it's heads on or tails on the left, heads or tails on the right. You want your outcomes to agree here, your outcomes to disagree if you're getting different answers. And of course, if you answer green for heads and red for tails, then you have exactly the right correlations. Agreement here, disagreement there. If you answer red for heads and green for tails, it also works. Okay. All right, so now here's a chance for the rest of you. We have the next challenge. Just like the first challenge, the same setup. Now, whenever the same measurement is made on A and B, the outcomes should disagree. And whenever different measurements are made, the outcomes should agree. Okay, so think about it amongst yourselves. You talk amongst yourselves. Think about it for a few minutes. And let me know how to do this.
Is there anything else?
Okay, who's wants to, anybody want to volunteer a description of a strategy? Oh, way at the back over on the right. Sorry, same?
Yeah. So one person should get that. One person should say heads is green, the other person should say heads is red, and one person should say tails is red, and the other person should say tails is green.
Yes, exactly. That'll do it. Well done. That's your prize. right, so here we want the outcomes to disagree along the top and the bottom and to agree on the diagonals. And so if they answer, say, green, red, and red, green on the other side, then we get exactly the right pattern of correlation. Okay, here's your final challenge. Slightly more intricate. Now, whenever the measurement T is made on both sides, the outcomes should disagree. Otherwise, so in the case where they're both heads, or heads and tails, or tails and heads, the outcomes should agree. Okay? So again, take a few minutes to think about how to do it. I have a Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'll wrap up in the next 5 minutes or so. Good. Yeah, we can ask questions then. Yeah, good. Okay. Do we have any proposed answers? I saw your hand first, so.
Let one person always say green, whatever it is.
So let's make it the left person?
Yes.
The left okay, person. So whether they get heads or tails, they're going to say green.
Green.
Yep.
And for the right person, if they get tail, they say red.
Okay.
And if they get head, they say green.
Okay, let's test that. So if they both get T, they're supposed to disagree. And they do. They disagree. So that's good. If they both get heads, they're supposed to agree. So they do. That's good. And here, they're supposed to agree, and they do. So that's good. But here, they're supposed to agree, and they disagree. So it doesn't work. Think about it a bit longer. Okay, what do you have a proposal? Sorry, there is not a. It can't be done. Okay, explain to me why it can't be done.
Because if T and T both have a difference, they need to move them down to each one. So the head, so on one head, say has to be green to compensate for that green T, and the other head has to be red to compensate for that T. So the H and H can't match up in that case.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. You win the prize for this one. It can't be done. There you go. So let me just go through that argument one more time. So suppose, for example, here's one way to, another version of the argument you just gave. Suppose that on the right, they're prepared to answer green for T. Then to make sure that we get the agreement here, that means that on the left, they'll have to answer green for H. And to make sure you get this agreement up at the top, that means you'll have to answer green here. And to get this agreement, you'll have to answer green here. But now your outcomes don't disagree. And if I'd started with red here, it would have been the same. And you can go through all 8 possibilities for assignments of colors to each of these 4, and you'll find that none of them work. None of them satisfy these correlations. So it can't be done. That's a set of correlations that you can't generate in this way. So now, question, what's the highest probability that you could win this game? Right. So if we play this game many, many times, and we ask what's the chances of collecting the prize at the end?
75%.
75%, right, because this strategy I just gave you actually is the is one of the optimal strategies. There's always sort of, at worst, you'll fail one out of the 4 for one out of the 4 times. And remember, these HH, HT, TH, and TT are equally likely with the coin flips. So 75%, the game can be won. Now, question. Suppose I did this experiment in the lab. I took a pair of entangled particles. I did 2 measurements at the end. I calculated the statistics. How much do you think, what fraction of the time do you think I could generate these correlations? I could win the game if I'm using quantum particles. 100, I heard. What if you think that they're going to be, this should be explained causally in the way that we've been describing with, like, you know, a local strategy that the particles have and they go out? You'd expect 75%, which is what we have here. So the surprising thing is that in quantum theory, 85% of the time, this game is won. So it's not exactly 85. It's actually 1/2 plus 1 over 2 root 2, which is very close to 0.85. And that's kind of mysterious, because we would have expected 75%. When we go and we do it in the, so this is what the theory predicts. If you go and you do it in the lab, you find that it's corroborated, that it is about 85%. So here's a question. How do you imagine, suppose we were doing the game the way we did it today, and we found that our volunteers, if we did it over and over again, we found our volunteers were winning 85% of the time, not 75% of the time. What would we think might be happening? How could they be cheating? Yes. If they were communicating from one end to the other, like somehow if they had some strategy for saying, I got H over here, you should react accordingly. How else could they cheat? Yes?
Somebody can tell them from here.
Right. Somebody might know and relay it to them, which is another kind of communication. And what if we had Alex and Marie in on the cheating? What are the possibilities?
Have a double-sided coin.
Double-sided coin, yeah. So if the coin wasn't really a fair coin but was biased, or if they could sort of surreptitiously enforce a particular outcome, make it look like it was a random but it wasn't, and correlated with what the strategy of the other person was, that would all be ways to get around this. So the problem with sort of imagining that, you know, it's rigged with the coin flips is that if we do this in the lab, then we're imagining that somehow the properties of the particles in the beginning are correlated with the random coin flips on either side. That seems kind of implausible, right? So in the lab, it's not a game show. You know, we have particles. Why would they be, their properties be correlated with the coin flips on either side? Doesn't seem very reasonable. And when you say, well, what if the particles somehow manage to communicate to one another across the lab and say what kind of measurement is being subjected to one particle, you get the following problem, which is, if you've seen relativity theory thus far, this is a space-time diagram, I can do this experiment in such a way that the particle on the right over here has to, so there's a measurement, at one time it learns what the measurement is, and then it has to generate an outcome. And it can be asked to generate that outcome long before a message about what measurement was chosen on the left has time to reach it, even if it travels at the speed of light. So if I did it this way, then I say, look, there's no possibility of communication of the measurement choice to the particle over here, because even though that communication is happening at the speed of light, it won't have time to get there. And people have done experiments with this particular setup, and they still see this 85% violation. That's the sense in which this prediction of quantum theory seems to be in tension with relativity theory. Okay, so let me wrap up by getting back to this causal stuff. So we asked, could this causal structure explain what we've seen? This is a way of writing the particular correlations we described in that third experiment. And what we found is the answer is no. This causal structure just can't do it. It can only get up to 75%. It can't get 100% or 85%. So then you say, well, what about this causal structure, where the setting on the left causally influences the outcome on the right? That's like our cheating, where there's communication from the left to the right. So one thing you can say is that, you know, if these guys are in relativity separated, this is very implausible, because it would seem to violate relativity theory. But we can say something more now. We can say this is also a really bad explanation of what's going on. Because if you look at the independences in this stuff, this correlations we saw, well, the settings, x and y, are independent. But you also find these independences. So the outcome on the right is independent of the setting on the left, right? So if I look at this distribution here, the distribution, say, over B is just random, 0.5 plus 0.5 1. And over here, the distribution over B is also 0.5 1 and 0.5 0, regardless of what the values of x and y are. And so that tells me that, you know, B is uncorrelated with x, even if I know y. And that's another way of saying I can't send signals faster than the speed of light. I can't toggle the setting here and see different statistics here. If I could do that, I could send signals faster than the speed of light. So we observe all this. We observe that we can't send signals in either direction. Our settings are independent. And if you think about it, if there were an arrow here, I would expect x and p to be correlated, right? I don't see that they're correlated. So the only way that this could explain what we've seen is with this funny fine-tuning, where we could choose the parameters very carefully to wash out this arrow. And that's implausible. So you rule out this guy as well, right? So it's not just intention with relativity. It's a bad explanation causally for what's going on. It can't really explain the independences. And so you start going and looking at others, like maybe there was a conspiracy and it wasn't a coin flip here. It was determined by some other variable, which also determined the outcome on the other side. Well, that would tend to make X and B correlated in general, because they have a common cause. But X and B are not correlated, so it's a bad explanation. So we rule it out. And we go looking for all possible causal structures among these guys. Oh, here's another one. Influence backward in time from X to lambda. That doesn't work because it correlates X and B. So when you ask, out of all the many possibilities, what could work, the answer is nothing. There is no causal structure that can simultaneously give you the strengths of the correlation that we see quantum mechanically. That was our third game. But also, there's no causal or that can explain it without using fine-tuning. And that's, I think, a nice way of putting the mystery, that all this machinery for trying to figure out how we could possibly causally explain correlations, here, it doesn't work. And what we're left with is the question of how do we explain the things we see in quantum theory? What we put in was this principle that correlation should be explained causally. I don't think we should get rid of that. You know, if I'd like to say, if I go to my doctor and I say, I read about this correlation between something I'm doing and some illness, and the doctor says, I don't believe correlations need to be explained causally, I say, OK, I want a new doctor, because that's just irrational. You know, science is about explaining correlations causally. So it's hard to give up on that. And this no fine-tuning principle also seems really solid. And yet, they generate this contradiction. So that's the puzzle. And I am happy to answer all your questions over lunch. So let me leave it there. Thanks a lot for your attention.